As the temperatures drop, concerns rise over Russian attacks turning to critical Ukrainian infrastructure needed for warmth.
President Volodymyr Zelensky, in one of his latest evening speeches to the nation, emphasized that there will be more attacks, particularly on energy facilities, as winter is approaching.
Plus, the unseen but very real emotional wounds the war is having on civilians, families, and particularly children.
Children learn the calibers of weapons and bullets before they learn the alphabet, and they learn their way to the bomb shelter before they learn their way to kindergarten. These things are not going to simply dissolve over time.
And later in the program, with war in the Middle East, Russia looks for middle ground in its relationships with Israel and Hamas. Today is Monday, October 16th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. Russia's deputy foreign minister has reportedly told President Vladimir Putin that as the situation with Israel and Hamas continues to escalate, there's a risk of conflict spiraling out of control. This as Russian missile attacks on Ukraine continued through the weekend and overnight into Monday. I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for the very latest.
Here in Ukraine, we're experiencing more attacks on the energy infrastructure particularly, and over the night as well, it was a massive attack, which was partly targeting energy infrastructure in the west part of the country. In addition, over the weekend attacks on the energy infrastructure in Kherson region. This period of time, a year ago, Russian Federation was already launching attacks, very intensive attacks on the energy infrastructure of Ukraine. And now it's also starting this again. So at the moment, basically, Russia is gradually launching a new wave of attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. And over the weekend, as I already mentioned, it was Kherson region. Over the night, it was Khmelnytsky region. And President Volodymyr Zelensky, in one of his latest evening speeches to the nation, emphasized that there will be more attacks, particularly on energy facilities, as winter is approaching. And he warned that Ukraine should prepare, and Ukrainians particularly should prepare for that. I will quote him. He said that we must be aware that there will be more such Russian strike with the approach of winter, more on generation facilities and on the network. He also mentioned that Ukraine is doing everything possible in order to protect energy facilities in terms of the air defense, but again, not for every region is enough.
Some big concern with the winter coming, of course. And it sounds like you may have a bit of information regarding children that have been deported to Russia, Ukrainian children.
Yeah, actually, the deportation of Ukrainian children to Russia by Russian forces and Russian officials is a huge problem of this war, and Ukraine is very much concerned, and Ukraine is talking about this on the level of International Criminal Court, and as we know, already International Criminal Court already issued warrants for the arrest of President Putin and Russian children's ombudswoman Lvova Belova, which happened some time ago. Now we have additional information that, according to some media outlets, this was confirmed that through the mediation of Qatar, more Ukrainian children will be returned sometime soon. And according to Qatari officials, even more children should be returned under this, according to the sources that, unfortunately, we cannot verify independently at this point. But still, we're hearing that Qatari officials are negotiating with both Kyiv and Moscow in order to arrange this return of Ukrainian children. What's important to mention here is that what was confirmed by the Ukrainian officials that almost 20,000 children were illegally taken to Russia by Russian forces, and only around 380 have been already returned. Mm-hmm. So for Ukraine, this definitely remains one of the biggest concerns.
Do you think this is a bit of renewed hope that these families could see their children again and these children could be back to where they belong?
Well, definitely hope. However, as we can see, this really is a very slow-going procedure because it's really difficult to negotiate with the Russian side. At least this is what Ukrainian officials were saying also some time ago, that it's really difficult to negotiate with Russia on this particular case, and the terms of this returning of Ukrainian children are very, very complicated. However, yes, there's definitely hope. And Ukrainian officials have also mentioned previously that they are asking everyone, so every ally and every country who can help in this to return children to actually take a step forward. So we'll see how this will go. But as I said, this is a very, very big concern for Ukraine.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
With a history of supporting Hamas, but cautiously warming relations with Israel, Russia has been left with some tough choices by the Palestinian group's terrorist assault on the Jewish state and Israel's unsparing response. Its rhetoric so far suggests that Moscow is looking for a middle ground while seeking ways to turn the war to its own diplomatic advantage. Ksenia Turkova has the story.
Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel has complicated Russian policy in the Middle East. The Kremlin has had cordial ties to Hamas and Iran. Tehran has provided Hamas financial and material support. But Putin has also cultivated close ties with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Russian TV presenter Vladimir Solovyov, whom the U.S. State Department has called a Russian propagandist, said he cannot sympathize with, quote, Palestine, adding, one cannot fight for the righteous cause with unlawful means. Since Hamas's attack on Israel, Russian state media has been caught between competing geopolitical alliances, says Ksenia Kirillova, an investigative journalist and analyst with the Jamestown Foundation.
Since they are fighting Nazism in Ukraine, they need to involve loyal Jews in that. So they need Israelis to strengthen their idea about Nazis in Ukraine. But we know they would never radically condemn Hamas and other such groups, because, yes, they are Russia's allies.
Kirillova says Russian state media has consistently accused the U.S. of ignoring UN resolutions, recognizing the Palestinian people's right to an independent state, and claimed that has made violence inevitable. So, Kirillova says the primary Russian state media narrative is that the U.S. harmed both Israel and Moscow, and Russia needs to be brought back into the regional peacekeeping process. Russia also welcomes the distraction from Ukraine, says Kirillova.
The main narrative is happiness over Ukraine receiving less attention in the near future. On top of that, the state media insists American military arsenals are stretched fairly thin and the country won't be able to help Israel and Ukraine equally. And that might lead to a rift inside the U.S.
Yet both the U.S. and Europe have reassured Ukraine the aid would keep coming. Kirillova says Russian propaganda is focused on creating the sense that wars are raging everywhere and it's the West's fault.
They want to show how international institutions are dead and it's America's fault. The U.S. failed to keep the world at peace. And they are to blame for starting conflicts.
Russian state media couldn't resist picking at Russians who, after Russia invaded Ukraine, left their home country for Israel. State TV channels have even advised these people to arm themselves and go protect their new motherland. Ksenia Trukova for VOA News, Washington.
In his nightly address on Sunday, President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine is working to evacuate nearly 260 of its citizens from Gaza and to fly other Ukrainians out of Israel. Ukraine's embassy in Israel said on social media Saturday that 207 Ukrainian citizens, including 63 children, were evacuated from Tel Aviv to Romania, and another flight took 155 people to Romania on Sunday. In a statement released on Sunday, the European Union's national leaders say they back Israel's right to defend itself in line with humanitarian and international law. Chairman of the leaders' summits, Charles Michel, noted the impacts of civilians being uprooted, including due to Russia's war on Ukraine.
There is a major risk of migration and movements of a large number of people to neighboring countries. Ladies and gentlemen, the Union has always been and must always be a steadfast advocate for peace and respect for international law, as in the case of Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine. We must address all these urgent challenges together in unity in line with the treaties and with our fundamental values.
And over a year of intensifying hostilities in Ukraine continues to threaten the lives and well-beings of tens of thousands of families, I spoke with Greta Euling, teaching professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and author of the new book, Everyday War, about how the wars are having deeper and lasting impacts on civilians in the affected areas.
Given the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and, of course, recent events in the Middle East, more and more civilians are the collateral damage. They are bearing the brunt of these horrific wars, even though they're not in the conflict themselves and through no fault of their own. How significant is this, and what is the impact to these folks, especially particularly in Ukraine where you've spent some time?
You know, I think that it's highly significant. You mentioned that this is a pattern from, you know, from Gaza to Ukraine, and it's a pattern that we've been observing for a long time. I think that to answer the question of how civilians are affected, they're affected in the familiar ways that we're so aware of injury, death, sex and gender-based violence, the destruction of infrastructure. But they're also affected in less talked about ways, less studied ways, which is that relationships are destroyed. And perhaps the best example of that is the removal of children from Ukraine that, you know, rips them from their families of origin, only to be only possibly reintegrated much later with more upheaval in their lives. But I think this is really significant because the literature on individual trauma resulting from war is very rich. We know a great deal about it. We're learning every day how to treat it. The literature on how geopolitical conflict takes place is also extremely rich. But what I try to do in my book is look at this in-between layer of what happens between people and their relationships, whether it's parent-child, romantic, friendships. And what I found when I did my research in Ukraine was that 70% of the people that I interviewed had either witnessed the destruction of friendships or new tensions and even the disintegration of family relationships, and which that too has profound implications for both their survival and the outcome of the war. So I often give you this example of Alexandra, who discontinued her university studies so that she could provision her father with things like night vision goggles and camouflage gear, tactical gloves. She knew the people that he would be killing as a sniper were her former neighbors and friends. But this idea of everyday war is that it's a conscious and creative way that you engage war and participate in it in a pragmatic and really self-defensive stance to both preserve the connections that you want to preserve and contribute to national defense.
So what I'm hearing is that it doesn't just bring people together, it also is tearing them apart?
Exactly. And I think that I like the way that you phrase that because, you know, at the same time that relationships were disrupted and reconfigured by war, this everyday kind of war that draws in civilians in my research also produces ethics of care. When I started listening to stories of the war, I saw this pattern in which people made decisions based on safeguarding others or tending to their emotional well-being, you know, supporting what ethicists of care have been arguing about, like, you know, the kind of morality that we're most familiar with is the kind of individualized, moral, rational thinking type. But there's this other kind of ethics that happens that has to do with civilians' moral thinking about human vulnerability and making difficult choices when established rules like the distinction between civilians and combatants have been upended.
Right.
And so a perfect example of this is, you know, people had to decide, should you cook for your family at home or for the internally displaced at the shelter? Should you, you know, I spoke with some newlyweds, a woman who was newlywed, and her husband decided he wanted to stay with his parents, she decided that her top priority was evacuating her parents. So their marriage dissolved. But so it's these strategic choices that are based on care. And at the same time that relationships could disintegrate, new ones were forged. And previously, you know, people who were previously just acquaintances could become close allies.
And what about the children? We here in the U.S., we have so-called lasting baggage from things much, much less horrific, you know, that we carry with us that are just sort of embedded into our psyches. But, you know, how do children come through this, and what happens to them after this is their childhood?
Exactly. And, you know, I think that this will define and shape a generation. You know, my friend Carilla pointed out that children learn the calibers of weapons and bullets before they learn the alphabet, and they learn their way to the bomb shelter before they learn their way to kindergarten. These things are not going to simply dissolve over time, but will have a very profound shaping effect. And in terms of like the emotional coping with war, I found sort of an emotional mitosis in which some people normalized the violence going on all around them as a way to simply get on with life. And sort of minimize the magnitude of what was happening. But other people were troubled by that very minimization and sought to work with others to basically address the trauma that is inevitably associated with war and conflict.
And of course, people, you know, who've just had a basically comfortable life are now completely displaced, whether it be in another part of the country or in another country altogether. They've lost their homes, their towns have been destroyed. I mean, it's unimaginable how someone would be able to get through that unscathed emotionally.
Right. And, you know, as President Zelensky has said, every Ukrainian is a warrior. It's just a question of their role. Which role do they take up?
And of course, now we're seeing that civilians aren't just becoming collateral damage, but it seems like they're also being targeted to some degree. Of course, we're seeing that in the Middle East. And it would be hard to imagine that it's not intentional on some level with some of the targets that Russia has gone after, civilian targets specifically.
Yeah, and I think that modern warfare does target civilians with the aim of both destroying a population and bringing about change, you know. So if we go back to the children that are being removed from Ukraine, it's like a 1-2 punch. On one hand, many, many children are killed, and those who aren't killed, efforts are made to transform them into Russians. It's devastating.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about these important issues that are often, you know, a side note to the everyday destruction and bombing and killing. We appreciate your research and your time.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Greta Euling, teaching professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and also the author of the new book, Everyday War. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Voters in Poland turned out in some of the greatest numbers that have been seen in the country to cast their ballots in a general election Sunday. Opposition parties promised to repair the nation's constitutional order and its relationship with allies, including the European Union and Ukraine. However, it's unclear if there will be a clear winner. VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Mirosława Gungadze in Warsaw spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about results so far and what it might indicate.
The governing coalition, right-wing Law and Justice Party, that has been in power for 8 years, got, according to the exit polls, most of the votes on Sunday. However, they have been in power for 8 years. And many people I talked to at the voting stations, and many people, just residents of Warsaw and other cities, said that they had enough of this coalition. And it would be actually historic record that one party would be governing for 3 terms. So basically, what polls showed this election, that they do want change, and many of them said that they are looking for change and looking for getting their country back, as they said. An Ipsos exit poll published early this Monday gives PiS 36.6% of the vote, which would translate into 198 lawmakers in the 460-seat parliament. Opposition parties led by the former European Council President Donald Tusk's civil coalition are projected to win combined 248 seats. Official results after 50% of voting, the district has been counted, put peace on 38.3% and civic coalition on 27.8%, and the center-right way that predicted would be forming coalition with liberal opposition got 14.4%. Again, it's a 50% of the voting have been count, and generally more conservative rural areas are small, and small towns report their results faster than large cities where liberal parties are the strongest. However, as we predicted, it is a very close race, and as a result, Poland is entering the time of some political turmoil.
The opposition leader, Donald Tusk, is already declaring the beginning of a new era for Poland. So what are the implications of this new era?
I would not talk about new era yet, because this will be a longer, possibly longer process than maybe you Polish voters or even outside observers want. If President Duda will let Law and Justice Party to try to form the coalition and then their government, he has a right to do that, because the Law and Justice Party won majority of the votes. However, the experts say it is almost impossible for them to be able to form that coalition. So that means that the parliament opposition coalition will get the second try at the forming the government, and then President Duda could also decline to ask Law and Justice to try to form the government, given the parliamentary mass. So this is like a very, very difficult process. If the second parliamentary attempt fails, then President Duda will select another candidate for PM. And if that will fail, he can call a fresh election. So if all these stages pan out, Poland could be without a government into November and December, or heading toward a fresh election.
VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze in Warsaw, speaking with Kim Lewis. Russia's foreign ministry announced Monday that its foreign minister will visit North Korea this week. The announcement just days after the United States claimed Pyongyang has given Russia weapons of war to use in Ukraine.
Our information indicates that in recent weeks, North Korea has provided Russia with more than 1,000 containers of military equipment and munitions. Today, we are releasing imagery showing the movement of these containers from the DPRK into Russia by ship.
National Security Spokesman John Kirby, in a virtual news conference Friday, said it seems to be part of a growing partnership.
In return for support, we assess that Pyongyang is seeking military assistance from Russia, including fighter aircraft, surface-to-air missiles, armored vehicles, ballistic missile production equipment, or other materials and other advanced technologies.
Russia's president, meanwhile, is expected to meet Chinese officials in Beijing in a visit that will underscore China's support for Moscow during its war in Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamis reports.
Both Russia and China have forged an informal alliance against the United States and other democratic nations. Russian expert Alexander Gabuev says the alliance is vital for Russia, especially since the start of the war in Ukraine.
For Russia, China is its lifeline, economic lifeline, amid its brutal aggression against Ukraine.
He adds there's also a payoff for China in this relationship.
For China, Russia is a safe neighbor that's friendly, that is a source of cheap raw materials, that's a support for Chinese initiatives on the global stage.
Putin's visit to Beijing will be primarily to show support for Xi's latest project. I'm Karen Chamas.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.